Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello everyone and welcome back to New Books in East European Studies. I'm Marina, one of the hosts in this channel. Today I will be talking to Dr. Gediminas Lankauskas about his book The Land of Weddings and Rain, Nation and Modernity in Post-Socialist Lithuania. Dr. Lankauskas, welcome to our show. I was wondering if you could begin this interview by telling us a bit about yourself.
Yeah, sure. Hello. And thank you so much for inviting me to the show.
Thank you for being with us today. It is a great pleasure.
Yeah, same here. So I'm Gediminas Lankauskas. The people in Canada call me Gedis. I was born and raised in socialist Lithuania in the heyday of the Cold War. I studied English and linguistics at Vilnius University. And in the early 1990s, just when the Soviet Empire was crumbling, I moved to Canada. And that's when I discovered anthropology. Let me tell you briefly how that happened. At the time, I met a couple of Canadian anthropology professors who introduced me to the discipline, about which I knew virtually nothing. And they told me that anthropology was not just a social science discipline, but a way of seeing the world. They also added that when one learns how to look at the world anthropologically, there's really no going back. That couldn't be unlearned. So that intriguing introduction to anthropology as a way of seeing and being in a kind of existential sense motivated me to learn more about it. And since that conversation, which took place almost 30 years ago, hard to believe, I have learned a great deal about anthropology as a graduate student at Trent University in Ontario, and then at the University of Toronto, where I earned my doctoral degree and became a certified anthropologist. I'm still interested in literature and languages, which were so central to my early university education. I also have a great deal of respect for history. I firmly believe that the present is unknowable without the knowledge of the past. But anthropology by far is my favorite. And over the years, it has challenged, enlightened, frustrated, angered me, but has never disappointed me. And as I see it, and
I find some similarities between our paths. My previous degree is also not in anthropology, but yeah, sorry, I interrupted you.
Yeah, so I guess both of us are migrants from other disciplines, and I assume both of us are quite happy to be in anthropology. So, just a few more words about anthropology. As I see it, unlike any other discipline in the humanities and social sciences, anthropology gives one so much, how shall I put it, intellectual space and freedom to explore the world, and through that exploration, to get to know oneself better. So that's the beauty of anthropology as I see it. It's certainly a very demanding discipline, yet it's also tremendously rewarding. And these are some of the things I tell my students when I introduce them to anthropology. And I'm currently an associate professor at the University of Regina in Canada.
I'm sure that as you're coming from another discipline, when you tell your students about how you discovered anthropology, they are intrigued. So let's talk about your book, The Land of Weddings and Rain, Nation and Modernity in Post-Socialist Lithuania. It was published in 2015 by the University of Toronto Press. I had the pleasure to read it some time ago, as it happens to fit quite well with my own current research about wedding in Kosovo. So I am excited to be talking with you about it today. In the postscriptum, you call your book an ethnography of modernity in contemporary Eastern Europe. So could you tell us more about the concept of multiple modernities and the opposition modernity tradition, and how do you apply these concepts in the context of post-socialist Lithuania?
Oh, modernity. All right. Well, let me begin by saying that modernity as a concept enjoys enormous popularity and wide circulation in the social sciences today. Yet it's a concept that is often left uninterrogated, unqualified, and is simply seen as self-explanatory. Because it has so many references and meanings, modernity runs the risk of becoming a meaningless and lifeless concept, unless we ground it ethnographically in very concrete social and cultural contexts, such as post-socialist change in Eastern Europe. And this is what I attempted to do with the slippery concept of modernity in my book on urban weddings in Lithuania. Modernity becomes conceptually compelling and interesting when we pay close ethnographic attention to the ways in which it is embedded in social life as quote-unquote modern ideas, ideals, values, images, objects, or practices. Simply put, modernity becomes analytically helpful when we ask what it looks like, where it is located, what it feels like. In other words, when we inquire into what people of flesh and blood make of it and how they respond to it in their daily social lives. Also, ethnographic study of modernity allows us to complicate and critique theoretical perspectives which tend to see modernizing change as a smooth, unilinear transition to a new and, quote-unquote, more advanced social order. Ethnographic research shows, and that certainly has been confirmed by my fieldwork, that the pursuit of modernity does not necessarily result in desired modernization. Rather, this pursuit often produces all kinds of unintended consequences, disillusionment or disenchantment, and ambiguity. It was never my intent, I should point out, to make modernity as one of the organizing concepts of my book, but I couldn't possibly escape it. Early on in my research, I realized how central the idea of modernity in its many manifestations was to many of the people I talked to during my fieldwork in Lithuania in the late 1990s. It soon became apparent that for many of my respondents, modernity provided an important reference point in their effort to understand, assess, and importantly, to critique the ongoing post-socialist change. That change, which was so unsettling, disorienting, and at once very exciting and promising, was about leaving socialist modernity behind and embracing Western style modernity. In other words, about becoming modern European civilized normal as well, to use the words of my respondents. Now, in Lithuania, as elsewhere in Eastern Europe, after the demise of socialism, the pursuit of the modern West, and I use the modern West in quotations, of course, that pursuit was, and I would say still is, unfolding not so much as a process of distancing from a traditional social order, but as a process of leaving another, quote-unquote, failed modernity behind. And this is where things become a bit more interesting as I see it. We can think about modernity not just in contrast to so-called tradition, as classical social theory would have it, but also in relation to other kinds of modernity. We can start thinking about modernity as a self-referential category, as it were, one that defines itself in relation to various guises or manifestations of itself. The process of socialist modernization or westernization in Lithuania was and still is not only about negating and erasing socialism, but also about invoking the interwar period of re-political independence between 1918 and 1939, which is often remembered as a kind of progressive modern era to be celebrated and emulated today. Now, as we study these multiple modernities in conversation with each other, and I think that's an interesting and worthwhile thing to do, but we cannot, as we do that, we cannot, of course, lose sight of what is known as tradition. And as I show in my book, in Lithuania, the desire to be modern is articulated in relation to a wide variety of cultural forms seen to be representative of national tradition. Just to be more specific, forms such as folklore, handicrafts, and national cuisine, rite of passage customs, and even adherence to Catholicism, Lithuania's national religion, which can also be thought of as a kind of tradition. So as people strive to modernize their lives and to refashion themselves as quote-unquote modern persons, they wonder what will become of what they refer to as our traditions, which are intimately tied to national self-conception and to what my respondents often refer to as Lietuvybė or Lithuanianess. There was always a perceived risk of damaging and even losing tradition and its associated national identity in the pursuit of the modern. So ideas and ideals of nationhood were and continue to be key modalities through which Lithuanians apprehend, negotiate, and contest the unfolding modernizing changes as they simultaneously assert their national selves and allegiances. So yes, we can look at how different modernities talk to one another, and that's very interesting. But we shouldn't lose sight of tradition because it's also a very important point of reference in that broader national narrative that we see today in Lithuania. And that's probably true of other parts in Eastern Europe. So,
yes, that's really interesting, especially the part about modernity not being one modernity, but especially in the case of Lithuania, having like a second promise for modernity. The first one, the socialist one, having failed in the eyes of people there. So, yes, thank you for telling us about your understanding of modernity and tradition and how they interact. What really drew my attention, though, to your book was one method, I would say, that you are using. And this is the ethnographic collage. This means that Vida and Vigantis, so please, is Vigantis pronounced like this? Or how should this name be pronounced? Okay, so their story is a blend of several couples' wedding experiences. While they are real experiences, they did not happen to the same couple. So could you tell us more about this approach and what are some of its benefits and difficulties?
Right, sure. Well, Vida and Vigantas, who are the principal dramatis personae of my ethnography, they're sort of the main characters, if you will, of it, are real people. They do exist. They're not fictitious. I didn't invent them. They do live in Lithuania. Now, their names, however, are pseudonyms. Now, I describe and analyze the wedding as representative of urban middle-class marriage celebrations in 1990s Lithuania. Now, incorporated into this description and analysis are ethnographic examples from other weddings that I observed during my fieldwork. So that's what makes it an ethnographic collage or pastiche, we could say. Now, there are three reasons, I would say, behind this writing strategy. First is to provide a richer, more comprehensive representation of ways in which the post-socialist urban wedding is constituted and celebrated. The second reason would be to make the narrative more focused and coherent for the benefit of the reader. And finally, the strategy helped me as a writer to stay more centered and grounded ethnographically. Had I chosen to describe each and every wedding I observed, and there were probably around 20 of them that I watched, observed, or watched on video, or just sort of observed unfolding in, you know, real space and time. So had I described all of these weddings, I would have ended up with a very fragmented and potentially disorienting text, I imagine. So the difficulty with the technique of a textual collage was in deciding which elements from other weddings to incorporate into Vida and Vigantas' marriage celebration, and then how to weave those elements into it as seamlessly as possible. So that was sort of the more challenging part. But as sort of as a technique, as a collage, as a pastiche, I think it worked well because and frankly, I cannot imagine who else I could have described those weddings. As I said, if I described them individually, that would have taken me forever and would have created a lot of fragmented text. So that's the ethnographic collage.
Yeah, I really find this fascinating and kind of like use this in my own work. I'm not sure I would also call it ethnographic collage, but in your case, like people are two real people first, and then everything that you have described, you have actually seen. Whereas with my case, the people are made up, and the things I have described, they are real. Part of them I have seen, but some of them are just probable. Like, they're like, I read their conversations. Like, let's not take too much time with my research, but I really find interesting how you are still kind of like true to the story, but you make it easier for your readers to comprehend what is happening there. I really think that's the best that you could do with this data, and maybe this is actually something we have a message. I don't know, maybe there are many other contexts when this could be used, but it seems really appropriate in a rite of passage context when you're looking to many people's stories and comparing, and you want to give the impression of one rite of passage happening in different stages. So it was you that kind of like inspired me to do something similar. So really, thank you so much. So I was wondering about you call your work Chronotopic Project. Could you tell us more about your reading of Bakhtin's concept of chronotope?
Right. Well, let me begin by saying that one of the most salient features of the pursuit of Western modernity in Lithuania, and again, I'm pretty sure that that could be said of other parts of Eastern Europe. So one of the salient features of that process is a radical reconfiguration of space and time. I therefore find it helpful to think about this process in chronotopic terms. And I borrow the concept of chronotope or space-time, that's what it really means, from the work of Russian literary theorist and philosopher Mikhail Bakhtin. Bakhtin told us that time and space and social life are inextricably interconnected, and one cannot be understood without the other. And that's something that, surprisingly, we oftentimes forget. We sometimes write about social space and overlook the fact that it exists in and is shaped by time, or we examine social time and its associated temporalities, which is the past, present, future, neglecting to give due attention to its twin category of space. So it makes good sense to think of the ongoing changes in Lithuania today in chronotopic terms, because again, so many of those changes implicate space and time. Rewriting national history, resetting clocks to align the nation's time with Western Europe, changing the national holidays, or even attempts to envision what the future will bring are some of the examples of social engagement with time. Now, much of this temporal endeavor to reposition Lithuania in time, or re-time it, if you will, if you want to use that kind of word, involves space. In other words, retiming is about space. Okay, well, let's talk about space a little bit more. How is that space being reconfigured? Examples: redrawing maps, redesigning city squares, renaming streets, toppling statues commemorating persons associated with the Soviet past. Some of the examples of I call respacing of the nation. And once again, a process that is closely interlinked with its retiming. So respacing goes hand in hand with retiming. Just to paraphrase Bakhtin quickly here, space, he said, responds, I'm not quoting, just paraphrasing, space responds to the movement of time or historical change. The chronotope is also analytically compelling because it is so intimately tied to human agency. In other words, to what people do. And another nice thing about chronotope is that we can effectively use it as a category to think about broader processes of social change, about cultural phenomena on a much smaller scale. It is a handy It's a handy concept with which to study weddings, for instance, social occasions that mediate among many spaces, many temporal reference, and many social actors. And of course, that's something I discuss at length in my book. So the chronotope is a very, very helpful heuristic kind of category with which to think about social life in general, wherever, whatever social life we're interested in. I think, you know, all people everywhere, they exist in space and time, and our job is to understand how they engage with those categories of time and space. We need to learn how their chronotope works, or many chronotopes, really. So anyway, the chronotope is very, very helpful. It certainly helped me in the book. It helped me to think about the material in the book, and now in my other projects, again, the chronotope is very, very present, and again, very helpful. So Bachtin lives on.
Yes. My next question is actually kind of like related, because it is about embodied and sensory experiences. And you reiterate their role when approaching a space. And I mean, like, we do live in the space. We do receive a space through our senses. So how do you link this phenomenological framework of embodied experiences with the concept of time-space?
Okay, so the chronotope and, spaces and their associated temporal parameters, like all spaces are somehow in-timed, or they are in time. So they have temporal parameters. Spaces with those parameters become socially and culturally significant when they are animated or activated by the human body. When we talk about the human body, we of course talk about the senses. Now, an empty space is socially meaningless. Space becomes meaningful when social actors engage with it through their bodies and by extension through their senses. When they see a space, when they smell it, when they hear it, when they touch it. In other words, when they consciously experience the space with its temporal parameters in a phenomenological way. As a phenomenon, a space acquires significance when it is embodied. For instance, through ritualized action, through ritual, such as the wedding. Mm-hmm. Now, when... Mm-hmm.
So can you tell us more about how you connect the wedding with the chronotope? Why do you choose to concentrate on embodied and sensory experiences?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, so let's integrate the wedding in all this, because our listeners might be wondering where is this wedding that we were promised to hear about?
Right, okay, well, the wedding is coming up in a moment. So where were we? Right, well, space becomes meaningful, significant when it is embodied. And one way of embodying a space is, once again, through ritual, and the wedding is sort of is a good ritual with which to achieve that, or to strive for that embodiment. Let me give you sort of more concrete, examples. When people are physically present in a space, and that could be during a wedding. I'll give you even more examples later on. So when people are present in a particular space, their senses their senses trigger emotional responses, right? They stir up memories that take them to the past, bring up issues pertaining to identity. Space reminds people as to who they are, or maybe who they want to be. So, and on, we can give many more examples here. Our job as as ethnographers is to better understand and explain our informants' phenomenological experience of and responses to the spaces they engage with in social life. I think it is a helpful conceptual methodological strategy for investigating space and its temporal dimensions ethnographically. A more concrete example, and it's sort of from it is from my book. How are we to get a better understanding, or how am I to get, as an ethnographer, a better understanding of what the Vilnius Cathedral as a national quote-unquote phenomenon, this is where phenomenology comes in, right? National phenomenon, we're thinking about the cathedral space as a phenomenon, with its own space times, with its own chronotopes, of which there's so many, right? So how are we to understand that cathedral as a national phenomenon with its own chronotope? Well, how about we try to investigate ways in which the cathedral is experienced by people phenomenologically? How about we use a religious wedding ceremony at the cathedral as an ethnographic setting in which to describe and analyze that experience, that phenomenological experience? And that's what I attempted to do in my book, the cathedral and the experience of it takes up quite a bit of space in the book. And I hope that shows how time and space and experience of them, how they come together to yield some pretty valuable information about the people who are part of that experience. So it's a handy, helpful way of looking at the world and trying to understand it better. When we're conscious of the categories of time, space, what people do, how they experience things, when we put it all together, I think we can learn some interesting, valuable things.
Yeah, to me it seems that this that combined the phenomenological framework and the time-space concept kind of like help us understand better how our specific informants, or how would I say, like, so the people that we're interested in exploring, how they connect to the past and to the future, and how they formulate their identities, I would say. Would you agree here? Or
very much so, very much so. It's about connecting the past, present, and the future, and it's connecting oneself, one's selfhood, to those temporalities. And these connections happen when people actually in the space, when they experience the space. And the space, of course, talks back to them, right? The space makes these things happen, right? It enables those connections to the past and the future and the present. It's a moment where a lot of important things happen. So our job, once again, as ethnographers, to be mindful of these moments, to be very observant of these moments, to kind of get out of them as much as we possibly can ethnographically, because that's where a lot of because these moments can yield a great deal of sort of ethnographic knowledge that we're after. So
yes, I agree with you here, and I feel that the anthropology as a discipline kind of like has the prerequisites for such analysis, like with this main principle of participant observation. It kind of like puts the basis for such kind of like explorations. So I mean, like even methodologically, anthropology kind of has it. I don't know whether it is clear what I mean, but it kind of like really fits nice with the main anthropological principles and methods.
Right. Well, we do field work. We get to people very, very close. So we do get very close to the experiences. So once again, our responsibility is to understand those experiences better and to explain them to ourselves and other people. And one productive methodology just to study those experiences is what we just discussed briefly, sort of chronotopic and phenomenological view. I think it works quite well.
Yeah, that's my impression as well. So another thing that I was interested in was this connection that you kind of like, you're able to do the connection between the present and the future, the present and the past. And in chapter 2, you talk about the wedding as one of the instances where references to the future are articulated and objectified in the present, of course. But on the other side, in everyday talk, the possibility of normal future is negated. So people are not really very hopeful sometimes when they talk. And how do you think the rite of passage achieves to get the people feel more hopeful about their future?
The future is indeed central to the wedding's time-space or chronotope. This rite of passage is so significant culturally because it reproduces the institution of marriage, forges new social relations, and holds enormous promise of familial and national continuity. As rituals promising biological and social renewal, weddings make the future foreseeable or at the very least imaginable. We could say that weddings are preeminently futuristic and hopeful celebrations. As such, they are well equipped to project visions of things to come. Such projections are made, for instance, through, just giving you an example now, through the bride and groom's visits to different city spaces on their wedding day, spaces that could be seen as signifiers of a desirable future. Now, a more concrete example of that could be something I witnessed in the field, could be the bride and groom stopping by at a McDonald's restaurant for Big Macs between their civil and church ceremonies. Like, what is that all about? So this could be seen not only as a way of embracing the consumer modernity that McDonald's represents, obviously, but also claiming that modernity at a deeper level as desirable for the future. So it's just an example of how the wedding engages with the future, how it activates the future, how it sort of incorporates the future in its narrative. Just sort of one pretty simple example here, but I think it illustrates the point quite well. There are many other reference to the future at the wedding. For instance, wedding gifts are about expectations and hopes for the future. Some gendered gifts, such as kitchen appliances or a set of carpenter's tools, tell the bride and groom what kind of wife and husband they're expected to become. Gifts are also used to signal to the newlyweds that children should be part of their marriage. At one wedding, I remember the bride and groom received a baby booster chair with a doll sitting in it. So the message there is pretty clear. Wedding videos are also, well, exactly. Wedding videos are also full of imagery with messages about a prosperous and fulfilling future. And as yet another example, we could mention wedding toasts as an important discursive or linguistic means to articulate expectations and desires for the future. Weddings also bring in the past through foodstuffs associated with what is seen to represent traditions, such as dektine or vodka, or the so-called branchy cake are examples of the past's presence at the wedding. The traditional male and female matchmakers could also be mentioned here as participants representing national pastness. Whichever way they are signified, the past and the future, I would argue, are the privileged temporalities of the wedding. Its connections with the present, however, as I see it, are more uneasy and tenuous. One could argue that the wedding has a kind of hierarchy of temporalities, with the future obviously being at the top, as the most important temporality of the wedding, the past in the middle, and the present at the very bottom. In other words, the wedding is not super interested in the present. The wedding is all about distancing from it and kind of focusing primarily on the future and the past. Weddings, as we know, they are, you know, liminal events. They're the rites of passage. They are about taking people out of the daily ruts and routines and away from the mundane and the familiar. In other words, they're about taking people away from the present, from the familiar quotidian present. And that's their sort of job, so to say. And we still need to be engaged with time, right? That's part of, you know, what, you know, rituals do. They connect with us with time, with temporal parameters. And I would say, once again, the wedding is very good at connecting wedding participants to the future and the past. And actually, a good wedding, or a wedding is recognized or characterized as good, real, beautiful, precisely when it succeeds in connecting the participants to the future and to the past. Anyway, these are the temporalities of the wedding and their hierarchies as I see them.
So they say abnormal, but what do they mean by it? Maybe those people are struggling, let's say, economically to provide their livelihoods. Like, what is something that they would regard as quite abnormal? Let's say in the time of your fieldwork, if this is not the way people phrase it anymore.
What is normal in daily life, in the present? Is that what we're interested in?
Let me clarify, because I feel I haven't phrased it maybe the best way, but from what I heard, maybe it's a little bit like doing it black and white what you just said, but in order for a wedding to be regarded as beautiful, as real, as a really, really good wedding, and people to be kind of like happy with it, it kind of like should reference to past and to the future in a successful way. Is this like, do I understand you correctly? So So I was wondering, so if this is the definition of a normal or proper wedding, when we go back to the everyday and to the present, how do these definitions of normalcy change? What is normal within the everyday life, and why is there something that fails that make people to be less hopeful in their everyday life?
Yeah, well, there are many failures in day to day life, and so much of that day to day life is oftentimes described or perceived as very, very abnormal. So people talk about normalcy a great deal as something very desirable and as something that is very difficult to combine. Doing my field work, not so much lately, not so much the past 5-8 years, but during my field work in the late 1980s, the word normalcy was one of the was central to sort of many conversations, all kinds of discourses. So in other words, people were talking about normalcy a great deal. Now, normalcy was an important point of existential reference, as I see it. My respondents often assess their lives in terms of normalcy, articulated desires for what they saw to be normal, and bemoaned the perceived absence of normalcy in many domains of their lives. Just about everyone seemed to be striving for a normal existence. As one of my respondents simply put it, I just want to live normally now. Now, what would that actually entail? Let's just break this statement down a little bit. Normalcy was conceptualized in socio-moral terms. When talking about social relations within the family or in the neighborhood or at the workplace, the more tangible material aspects of daily life were also evaluated in terms of normalcy, just like being able to afford basic consumer goods. The availability of basic consumer goods was seen as sort of normal. That's how it should be. Having friendly, respectful relationships with your family members or your neighbors was seen as normal. So visions of normalcy, not unlike those of modernity, held the promise of a quote-unquote better life. Having more normalcy were seen as, or desires for normalcy, sort of bespoke desires of a better, more satisfying social existence. Now, there was a perception, which is still very true today, that people in the quote-unquote modern West led normal lives. And, well, now that we're heading to the capitalist West from the socialist East and are becoming more modern, we should expect normalcy to take hold here as well. So modern and normal were often used as overlapping categories. And just like much-desired modernity, normalcy proved to be difficult to attain. As I see it, normalcy is a concept with which to make sense of a profound and unsettling changes brought about by the so-called modernization. And it's also a concept that provided and still provides people with a vantage point from which to critique those changes and to distance themselves from them. So, that's normalcy. One of the many keywords that I heard in the talk of my respondents during my field work, and it's not as prominent these days anymore. Could be that people just disillusioned in normalcy and kind of gave up on it, but still want a better life because modernity, the pursuit of modernity, has not delivered that life yet. Life still remains very abnormal for many people. It's just that the word itself does not come up as often these days as it did earlier in my research.
So what they are normal? Those people are like struggling, let's say, economically to provide their livelihoods, or like what is something that would be really regarded as quite abnormal, let's say at the time of your fieldwork, if this is not the way that people phrase it anymore?
Well, just about everything would be regarded as abnormal. It was just sort of a master trope that enjoyed enormous popularity, as I mentioned. So in different domains of daily social life, people say that the rainy weather was abnormal, that the rudeness, of the drivers on the street is abnormal. Or would people say with indignation, is this normal? When is our life going to be normal? Prohibitively expensive consumer goods could be commented on by someone as, look, is this normal? I cannot afford any of this. Getting a meager pension that can, barely cover your utilities on a monthly basis. Was referred to or could have been sort of identified as, an instance of abnormality. So it was just a word, a trope with which to talk about the world, as well as a trope with which to critique that abnormal world. And as I argue, also a way to kind of distance from that world perceived to be abnormal. And it's also a way to once again articulate that desire for something better. And that something better was promised by Western modernity, which is sort of kind of on its way and arriving, but it's still not quite here. So life remains abnormal. And so what do we do? There's not much we can change about this life. So we turn to language, we turn to specific words with which to at least symbolically critique and challenge that abnormality that people perceived to be around them. So there's still a great deal of discontent and disillusionment, a great deal of kind of negative commentary on what's going on socially, economically, politically in Lithuania today. It's just that I don't hear the word normal used that often. But the discourse really hasn't changed. It's still ongoing. And if anything, I think it might have even intensified because people are getting increasingly frustrated. It's almost 30 years now since socialism collapsed, and our lives are still so abnormal. It's not what we expected. We wanted something very different. And we're sort of traveling in the wrong direction here. So there's a great deal of that kind of talk, which could still be seen as sort of, the talk of normalcy. It's just that the word itself, I don't hear that often. So Anyway, yeah, an interesting concept that could take us on a very long kind of discussion, and it could take us in all kinds of interesting directions. Of course, it's interesting how just a simple word can open up doors to much broader, deeper kind of conversations. So anyway.
So finally, I really appreciated that in your book I could read more about the challenges you have encountered while in the field. And I was wondering whether you can tell us more about that, what was most challenging, and maybe a piece of advice for beginning anthropologists who are researching rituals.
Well, there's a great deal of what I would call ritualized activity in Lithuania today. I cannot say whether there's more of it than there was 30 years ago. It's hard to measure that intensity, but it's certainly there. It's certainly very noticeable. Now, some of that ritualized activity is secular and state-sponsored. Some of it is religious, associated with the Catholic Church, and some of it is just grassroots, stemming from civil society. Now, to give you a few quick examples, there are 4 days in the Lithuanian calendar that celebrate the state and its sovereignty. These days are state holidays with a lot of ritual and celebration. Just this past summer, until July the 12th, I was watching the presidential inauguration in Vilnius, which struck me as quite ritualized and elaborate. It included the swearing of the presidential oath, several speeches, long promenades through the old town of Vilnius, and the day was wrapped up with a reception at the presidential palace to which 2,000 guests were invited. The video of the inauguration, which is 7.5 hours long, is available on YouTube in case someone's interested in seeing it. So just one example of how the state and its institutions are ritualized. There are Catholic...
I'm sorry.
Yes.
Sorry for interrupting, but this just wanted to clarify or to ask rather.
Right.
Would like normal people like me and you engage with these rituals? I mean, like the presidential is swearing, right? Like he's so would people watch it on TV, participate in some way, go.
Would they participate? Would they be part of it?
Yeah.
Oh, very much so. Oh, very much so. Yeah. Absolutely. July the 12th, on that day, the nation pretty much came to a standstill. Many, many people were glued to their TV screens, those who could. Participated in the celebrations themselves. So, it's something that many people participate in one way or another. Rituals or ritualized events are appreciated. They draw sizable crowds usually. I could go on with many other examples with ritualization. Here we're talking about how the state is ritualized. The church, of course, the Catholic Church is doing its own rituals and Easter and Assumption and All Souls Day and of course Christmas and all that could be mentioned. Ritual is very much part of familial celebrations, from baptisms to name days to weddings, of course, and funerals. And we could also mention less structured and less formal, more spontaneous ritual that one observes in countless festivals and street fairs in Vilnius, the capital, as well as in other smaller cities of Lithuania. So yeah, there's a lot of ritual to watch. Now, what are we to make of it? Well, as I see it, the intense ritual activity in Lithuania bespeaks underlying insecurities and vulnerabilities of the people. Reference to perceived fragility of things falling apart are quite common in daily talk and in the media. In this context, ritual could be seen as an effort to appease those feelings of disquiet and impending doom. And the prevalence of ritual, I think, also points to desires of belonging, of sociability, of togetherness, desires that intensifies at times over perceived threat or danger. And ritual is very much about stepping out of the present and activating the imaginaries of the past and the future, something we've discussed already. So we could also think about ritualization as a way of distancing oneself from, and again, critiquing that quote-unquote modernizing present that so many Lithuanians find disappointing and disenchanting. So that's one explanation, I guess, as to why ritual is so prevalent in Lithuania today.
Yes, I guess I'm really happy with your explanation, because it is not very important to measure whether it is more or less than before, but rather what it means, and to see that it is still prevalent and ritual is not dead in any case. So finally, one of the things I really appreciated in your book was your kind of like honest and detailed conversation about the struggles you had in the field. So the challenges, maybe not struggles, but rather the challenges that you encountered in the field. So to my opinion, it is as important to look at the process of gathering the material and the difficulties in the field work as to the material itself. I mean, like, the process shows itself many things about the place. So could you maybe really briefly share with our listeners what did you find most challenging when you were in the field gathering the material for this book?
Okay. well, there were many challenges, but I guess the biggest challenge in the field was accessing weddings. When I was preparing for fieldwork, it didn't occur to me that this would be an issue. I'm pretty embarrassed to admit that. I certainly underappreciated the fact that weddings are, of course, they are closed, private, familial celebrations that are not particularly welcoming to outsiders. Now, in Vilnius, on Fridays and Saturdays, one could observe weddings in public spaces such as the Palace of Matrimony, so-called palace, as well as in city churches or on the streets of the old town. But getting inside a wedding as a researcher was extremely difficult. And during the first 6 months of the fieldwork, I just couldn't attend any weddings because no one really wanted to have me there. So I was during that period of six months, I was busy conducting interviews, watching the media, working in the archives. But I still couldn't get into one single wedding, and I was getting quite concerned about my project. Because I was almost halfway through my fieldwork and still no weddings. Now, my identity as a complete stranger and a male anthropologist from Canada interested in marriage celebrations, came across as quite unusual and odd to some of my respondents. No bride or groom expressed any enthusiasm about having an anthropologist follow them around on their wedding day. And the thought of going to a wedding with a notepad and audio recorder made me feel increasingly uneasy and awkward. So I had to do something about this predicament if I wanted my project to succeed. And following the very smart advice of one of my neighbors, I became a videographer, an identity that made perfect sense in the wedding scheme of things. The video camera repositioned me in relation to the wedding, provided me with a role that any participant could understand and relate to, as opposed to the anthropologist with a notepad. It also, it sort of, the camera worked as a kind of master key magically that opened the doors for me, and in some cases to some of the most private and even intimate time spaces of the wedding, and was also a very handy data gathering tool. After the wedding, I would give a copy of the video I produced to the bride and groom, and with their consent, would keep a copy of the video for myself as kind of audiovisual field notes. Needless to say, my research project owes a great deal to the video camera. So thank you, camera. So that was a very, very big, a very big challenge, which fortunately I managed to overcome.
And were you familiar with? While we are on the topic on camera, were you familiar with how to use it so that people would be happy with the result? Or
absolutely not. I knew nothing about video cameras. I had to learn how to use it in an hour, pretty much. And it was a very steep learning curve, and I was not the best cameraman, that's for sure. I'll admit to that. I produced half a dozen, if not more, videos, and I still have them here in my data collection. It worked. Most importantly, the camera legitimated my presence. All of a sudden, this is holding a camera, gave me a legitimate identity in the context of the wedding. People knew who I was and what I was doing, as opposed to just being there as anthropologist. Well, what is an anthropologist? And what does this person do? And why? And so all these questions puzzled a lot of people. And that certainly didn't help me establish a rapport with the people. If anything, that identity of an anthropologist created a great deal of kind of chilly distance. And some of the people I approached, they told me kind of right away that just absolutely no, we don't want an anthropologist to follow us around on our wedding day. And I totally understand that. And it's a very, very personal event. So you don't want a stranger with a notepad of all things hanging around. So, but the camera worked wonders, and my research took off very quickly.
Any other challenging things that you would like to share, maybe before we?
Rituals are very demanding sort of events, social events to study, because they are They're very busy. They're multisensory. They're multi-sided and multi-temporal, as in that they take place in many different locations and unfold over an extended period of time. Certainly weddings do. They have many participants. And because most rituals, certainly not all, weddings certainly are, performances, right? Which means that there are audiences that watch the performance, right? So as a researcher then, with a camera or not, you're not only watching the ritual, but you're also watching the audience watching it, or you're supposed to be doing that. So there's a lot of, you know, watching that you have to do if you want to do it well. So yeah, it's a good idea to have a pretty good plan as to how you're going to position yourself. Well, first of all, how you're going to enter the wedding and how you're going to position yourself in it. And as I just said, the camera is very, very helpful. It helps you to enter and to position yourself. But then again, there's only so much one can capture with a camera. And still the best, you know, at the end of the day, the ethnographer's body is the best research tool. And the best way to learn how to use it is by doing ethnography. And doing the ethnography of ritual certainly gives the researcher a pretty good workout. Yeah, so it's challenging, but it's great fun, and it's very, very rewarding. So that's true of ethnography, I think, in general, and especially of ritual. So
yeah, thank you for this and like advice for anthropologists researching rituals, of whom I am. I really can confirm that it is really a workout, as you said, like a mind workout, I would say, to be.
Yeah. Well, no, physically, it's a workout for the mind. It's also, or for the senses, and it's also a workout for the body.
Right. I mean, like, to kind of like focus your attention in so many directions, it's almost impossible, and one does not know, like, should he or she be writing notes or taking pictures, or maybe what is better, like pictures or videos or notes, or one needs to do all of this at the same time, basically, and this is not possible,
right.
And then
well,
interacting with people there so you can see the comment, how they respond to the event. So it is basically really challenging if you want it to be in depth. Like, it's not enough to just be watching videos or something.
Right. And
watching videos online, for example. Yeah.
Right. And as a videographer, yeah, well, that's another experience altogether. But as a videographer, just another quick point here. Many wedding participants would sort of tell me what to photograph, where to run, what to see, and that was very helpful on the one hand. On the other hand, well, I had sort of my agendas. You know, I wanted to see, you know, other things, my plans, my intentions, and the intentions or the interests of the participants did not always coincide very nicely. So that just added more kind of disorientation and kind of hype to the entire experience. So, but at the end of the day, you inevitably pick up a great deal of very interesting and valuable knowledge and information, for sure.
Yeah, I really can relate to this, that people tell you, see, this important moment, you need to capture this or that. And yeah, I really can relate to this and how it is helpful and problematic at the same time. Well, I guess this is kind of like encompasses the relationship of an anthropologist with their informants. It is, the informants are both
right,
helping you
right,
and impeding
exactly.
the process at the same time. Yeah. But it is really a great experience and something that's really nice to be doing. So I was wondering, because we took up a lot of your time, could you maybe tell us really, really briefly what you're currently working on, and with that we can close our interview?
Well, I've moved away from weddings, although there's so much more that needs to be done. No ethnographic project is ever complete. You know, it's always a moving target. We always miss out on something, as we just discussed, really. You know, running around with a camera will show you a lot of different dimensions, so it will help you capture different dimensions of the wedding, but at the same time, you'll be missing out on all kinds of things. Now, some of the things that I overlooked in my study of the weddings, for instance, music and music making, which adds very interesting, very important sort of dynamic to the wedding that has not been explored, and I don't think it will ever be. Another thing could be mentioned, toasts at weddings are very interesting. Certainly very interesting. Toasts are very interesting at Lithuanian weddings. Anyway, I have did not include them into my book. So there's some holes there. And I don't think, as I said, I'm going to be going back to the wedding to do more research. I've moved on to another topic, a topic that still is very much connected to nuptials, to marriage celebrations. That topic is social memory. And it's not a new topic, because as I said, I explored it a little bit in my study of weddings, and I also have done some research on social memory, have some publications with the results of that research. So just to sum it up very quickly, I'm specifically interested in the Soviet socialist past, and which is still very present in the consciousness of many Lithuanians almost 30 years after the demise of socialism. And in my current project, I want to document the ways in which this past is recalled, and of course, to better understand why that past continues to matter so much. In a society where a dominant discourse is centered around the idea of European, modern, Western future. So that's where I'm heading. Certainly a way, who knows?
So you're doing an...
Yeah, go.
Yeah. You're doing an ethnography again,
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure what I'm doing, but I certainly want to do a lot of interviews. I'm thinking about a project that would focus for the most part on the statues of kinds of Marxist-Leninists that were toppled back in the 1990s, when we think that people would forget about something like that 30 years after the fact. And that's not the case. There's a pretty vigorous debate going on as to what to do with those statues. And there's still a few remaining, well, at least one remaining, and this debate whether to leave it or whether to remove it. So there's still a lot of... deliberation as to how to engage with that socialist past. So that intrigues me. It has always intrigued me. It But I think now that I'm done with my wedding project, I could sort of become more focused on memory, and specifically through the statues. But I certainly want to bring in all kinds of voices and make them part of my work. So I haven't thought through the plan. The project is not sort of finalized yet, but this is the direction that I'm moving in right now. So who knows? It may take me back to weddings in some unexpected way.
Yeah. Well, there is no use, because this is not needed, because the project that you're describing itself is very interesting, and it happens to interest me as well, even though I haven't done any projects. But I have read and thought about these things coming from Bulgaria. I'm coming from Bulgaria, so I can see that it is an important topic for the whole Eastern European art. Yeah,
very much so. Yeah. This is not kind of a Lithuanian phenomenon. It's the so-called memory movements are everywhere in Eastern Europe and pretty much around the world. So, and of course, there are many other pasts that are remembered. I'm interested in just the Soviet past, the most recent past. But there's sort of the interwar past. There's the czarist past. There's the medieval past. So the many different pasts that one could be focusing on, but all of them tell us that the memorial consciousness is very much alive and well in Lithuania and elsewhere.
Thank you for this conversation, Dr. Lankauskas. I would be interested to discuss with you your next project as well, of course, in another episode. And I wish you success with it, and I hope that working on it will be very inspiring for you.
Well, thank you so very much, and thank you for having me. It was fun.